Hi everyone, I'm Gary Knoll. This is going to be a very informative hour. We're going to talk about how administering zinc to COVID-19 patients could help towards their recovery. This is from the Hospital del Mar Medical Research Institute in Spain. Mortality in this patient group was 21% compared to 5% of those with higher levels of zinc in their blood. That's important because that means it's supporting other science showing zinc is important when you're in a hospital with any kind of infection. From the University of Barcelona and the European Molecular Biology Laboratory, published in Scientific Reports, green tea modulate facial development of children with Down syndrome. Boy, that could help. Also today, I'm going to talk about eating meat raises the risk of heart disease and diabetes and pneumonia. Who says? Oxford University. United Kingdom researchers find a link between regular meat eating and 9 of these non-cancerous illnesses. That's serious. Now, there's separate ones on cancer. This was published in the British Medical Journal as well. Also today, the risk of ADHD may be lower if children grow up in green environments. Well, then it's not a brain malfunction as such, because the environment they're in impacts their emotions, their moods, so therefore this is a maladaptive behavior. Blueberries can boost your mood and improve memory. University of Reading, also in the United Kingdom, on a lot of different levels. And there's a toxic synergy between aluminum and Alzheimer's disease protein. The Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology says this. Why is that important? Because many of the vaccines, including the flu vaccine, that seniors are encouraged wrongfully, based upon the science, every year, they're taking aluminum as an adjuvant to make the vaccine more powerful, and that can lead to Alzheimer's disease, but they don't tell you that. We will. And something I wrote a book about 40 years ago, Biofeedback, University of Rochester. Biofeedback shows promise as mental health treatment. We knew that back then. In fact, I got Dr. Martin Shepard, Dr. Alan Putterman, Dr. Donald Mullen, the Albert Ellis Center, Dr. Carmi Harari, one of the most respected psychoanalysts in America. These were all heavyweights. And I had given them information of what I was doing at the Institute of Applied Biology, where I was doing research on different forms of meditation, hypnosis, but also biofeedback on helping people with depression, Alzheimer's, schizophrenia, and right across the board it was working. But there was no science on it at the time. And I must have done at least 20 experiments just this one topic. But it didn't go anywhere. It went somewhere as far as those who knew me and those who saw the work and came to the lab and saw people improving and talking with them and saying how their anxiety, how their panic attacks were no longer viable because they were doing biofeedback and meditation. And then Dr. Roy Glaberman, who I think is still practicing, he was over on 86th Street, really nice guy. And he was the first guy I knew in New York using the tanks, the saltwater tanks, the isolation tanks. And that also worked. Unless you fell asleep in one. My buddy John, I never will forget this. My buddy John Q went to sleep in one. And you're only supposed to be in an hour. He must have been there 4 or 5 hours. He came out and he looked like a mummy. His skin was... He said, "Is this spermidized?" I hope not. When your skin's all wrinkly, you look suddenly 85 years old and you're only 30. But boy, did it relax people. Wow. And then it became very popular. You had to book it like 1 o'clock in the morning at one center downtown just to get to your isolation. That went out of favor, but there's no reason that it went out of favor, except for people. Other trends came along because it worked. If you have a chance to get an isolation tank, they're probably very inexpensive today. It will completely zone you out. For if you have lower back pain, if you have leg pain, intermittent claudication, pains in the calves, if you have circulatory problems, if you have depression, an isolation tank, wow. It's just water filled with salt, so it's very thick salt water, so you float. You don't sink, and it's very warm. And some people say it's like experiencing returning to the womb, and it gives that wonderful sensation. Anyhow, for depressive disorders, it works. ADHD and ADD also. Anxiety, it works. So these are the topics that we're going to be exploring. But also today, I'm going to do a commentary. This is a commentary. It's an original in-depth investigative report. And it shows you what happens when, as a country, we do not think deeply enough. We're so caught up in our current cultural mindset that we don't look for the evidence-based proof that a product, let's say it's a vaccine or an antidepressive medication or an antipsychotic medication or a heart medication or cancer medication, how do we know it really works? If they were using a placebo, was the placebo an inert substance? Because frequently they use another drug, a competing drug, and that's not a placebo. That'll give you false results, and that's done all the time. And what about the reputation of the company? Now, here's the question I'm going to ask now, and I'm going to ask you to call in after my commentary. And our talkback number to call in is 888-874-4888. When Martha Stewart was arrested, arraigned, found guilty of lying about insider trading, just lying, not telling the truth. She was not found guilty of insider trading. She spent some time in prison. And for over a decade, every time you heard the name or Martha Stewart, it was convicted, you know, a former criminal. Only in the last few years has she regained some measure of her reputation. What about a company that has not just been found guilty of lying about something, but doing things many, many times, and hurt people, cause people to die and be injured? Wall Street says, pay the fine, we love it. Stock goes up. And investors, including pensions and other groups that invest in that company for their members, everybody's happy. Why would we ever believe anything that company did after that, since they had a long serial record of lying? And that's just not one company. That's virtually all companies. All Wall Street companies, all pharmaceutical industry, every type of nuclear industry, guilty. And yet we have a whole society that rewards, respects, and honors those who fail. Why? Why do we do that? And yet, if you and I do something and we're found guilty, that's the only thing anybody will ever use to mention our name, moniker us with this negative scarlet letter. But we never do it for the big people. And we go ahead and buy their products as if somehow there's nothing wrong with that. Okay, that's what I'm going to ask you. Because I'm going to do an article today. It's entitled, Why Should We Trust a Vaccine from a Condom Maker? All right? And this will be posted on PRN.FM. Also today, what if it is proven or can be proven that Anthony Fauci and a small group of people around him receive millions of dollars after gain-of-function research was banned by Barack Obama? He did it quietly vis-a-vis the University of North Carolina and Wuhan Institute, and that is where the coronavirus originated. Now, right now, we have multiple people, including probably the world's leading scientist. He won Scientist of the Year 3 years running, showing that it could not have been coming from nature, could not have been a bat and just evolved naturally in the bat. That is not physically possible based upon what he's discovered about the genomic sequencing, etc. But no one in the mainstream, no one at the World Health Organization, no one at the CDC, certainly no one in Anthony Fauci's circle is going to acknowledge it. So wouldn't it be remarkable if the man mishandling everything about COVID was the person responsible for causing COVID? Would we feel any differently? Would we admonish him? I'm interested in your answer. But wait till you see the proof, not speculation. All right? That's coming up today. I'm a big believer in looking at what the body's biochemistry needs. For that, you need to be tested, in spite of having no symptoms of anything, being ideally healthy. Look, I get tested many times a year. I go to the skin doctor 3 times a year. It takes about a half hour. He examines all my skin to see if any time when I was younger and wasn't aware, when I was in my teens and 20s and working out all summer in the hot sun and just gym shorts, if that damaged the skin today, manifesting as precancerous or cancerous lesions. Fortunately, that hasn't been the case. But I also have my C-reactive protein, homocysteine, fibrinogen checked to see if there's elevation, which can increase your risk of heart attack or stroke. I have my dentist examined twice a year to see if there's any underlying loss of bone in the jaw. I'm as healthy as I can humanly be. But it doesn't mean you're invincible. It's because of what you don't see. A person developing breast cancer won't know that there's a tumor there for probably 10 to 20 years. Now, had they had annual thermography, which is safe and measures the differentiation in heat in different tissues, is much better than mammography, which is very dangerous. But that's not done, and it should be. So don't assume because you're without any obvious illness that there's nothing wrong in your body. How would you know if you're zinc deficient or vitamin B12, if you're vegan or folate deficient? You wouldn't. That's why I'm suggesting getting tested. Now, a lot of these tests are very inexpensive. But zinc is one thing you should be tested for because it's one of the single most important antiviral and immune modulating nutrients you can take into your body. This is a study from Hospital Del Mar Medical Research Institute in Spain, and they took a look and found that especially the elderly were suffering zinc deficiency and had far more problems with COVID. But then they are now giving vitamin D3 and probably will start giving zinc, as has been suggested by many mainstream physicians and scientists now, prophylactically for people at home, but also for everyone going into a hospital environment, ICU. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Nutrients. So mind you, where there's higher proven death rate with people with lower zinc, and 1 in 4 patients were lower in zinc, so you're talking about 80%. That's important. And by the way, it grows more severe if you have elevated C-reactive protein or interleukin 6, which mediate the inflammatory response and are partly responsible for causing the what we call cytokine storms. Virtually all the protocols I put together for the people who are deadly ill, and mind you, I only work with terminally ill people, and I never start with nutrition. I never start with a protocol like that. I start with a life protocol. What would you like to live for? If you had more time, if you had weeks, months, or years added on to your life, what would you do with that time that you would not have otherwise thought of doing? And suddenly, it's like you just lance a psychic abscess What pours out is the muck and mire of unrequited dreams and ambitions and joys. You also hear from people who had the resentments of what they didn't do at some point in their life, opportunities lost, relationships lost that shouldn't have been. And they kind of feel almost as if they've been relieved of this burden to say some of this to someone. And so I say, let's start there. And anyhow, I go on. I have to have a foundation of spiritual, and of course that causes the psychics, not the psychics, the skeptics and the quackbusters' brains to explode, since they don't believe in faith. And I base all my work on faith, all of it. So you can imagine them trying to understand anything I'm talking about. Wait till you see what I got coming up. I got some really good stuff. I'm not going to talk about it, but it's never been done before. It's never, ever, ever been done. There's not a single scientific study. So if I'm able to prove this scientifically, wow, will that cause people who have belief in a higher, whatever you want to call it. Call it anything you want. I call it the universal energy. How powerful it is in all of life's processes. I call it the exchange of energy, exchanging a negative for positive energy, the healing for diseasing energy. In any case, we see this all the time. When people no longer have anything worth living for, they die. So getting a person motivated, getting him inspired, get him to smile, get him to stop fearing death, the end of things, but rather the beginning of something new, is where everything starts. You're not going to see that in any medical school curriculum. Could you imagine? You know, they wouldn't know what to say, because they only deal with the pathology of disease, not the vitality of life. Totally different approaches. In any case, any physician, scientist, nurse who's qualified would like to ever sit in. And when I do a counseling, 2 to 3 hours, you're welcome to. Martin Feldman sat there for 2 years, every night, 7 nights a week, until finally he said, I got it, and went on and changed his practice. Do you know, after that, for the next 43 years, he never offered a single medication, and yet he reversed diseases in thousands and thousands of patients. Imagine what it would do for some of the people who want to help people, and I believe most do, but are using the wrong protocols. In any case, you've got to have zinc, and it's a big-time important nutrient, so let's just make sure we get our zinc, and let's make sure we get our green tea every day, anywhere from 200 to 1,000 milligrams. But in this case, green tea supplements modulate facial development of children with Down syndrome, and this was a Belgian and Spanish research study published in Scientific Reports as evidence about the potential benefits of green tea extract in Down syndrome. The researchers observed that the intake of green tea extracts can reduce facial, it's called a dysmorphology in children, you know, that strange look, and during the first 3 years of life. So one more thing, one more piece to a puzzle, because when Down syndrome is there, it's generally because of a third copy of chromosome 21, leading to an overexpression of the genes in this region and resulting in a number of physical and intellectual disabilities. And one of the genes, which is DYRK1A, contributes to altering brain and bone development in people with Down syndrome. And the green tea compound EGCG, epigallantoic catechin 3 gallate, is known to inhibit DYRK1A activity. So just good science, published in peer-reviewed literature at a good institution, showing that you can help people that before we didn't believe anything could help. And finally, from Oxford University, regular meat consumption is associated with a wide range of diseases that researchers not previously considered. We knew Loma Linda University scientists knew. Over 1,000 articles that we have from peer-reviewed literature showed, but obviously they weren't looking there. But this this was a large population-level study. A whole team worked on it. And they found, bottom line, you eat meat on a regular basis, increase in heart disease, increase in pneumonia, increase in diabetes. And that's all to your detriment. So here's the question. And I'd like people to call in and address this, please. With all the ads for bacon and sausages and dripping with ooey-gooey, you know, mucus-producing cheeses or whatever strange concoctions they make these with, what is it that is preventing us from making healthy changes? Because we're not. Only a tiny, tiny percentage of the American public are making conscious, healthy choices across the board about their health. The average person, the worse the combination of food, the worse to your health, the more they want to get it. Eat it. Eat it all. Eat 10 of them. So why? I'd like your input. 888-874-4888. I'm going to go to those questions soon. And by the way, if you have a child with ADD and ADHD, if you can get them into a green environment, into rural America, where there's lots of opportunity to buy farms, which are selling for dirt cheap prices, because that the way farming is done no longer works. And just not even to farm, but just to have the beauty of the landscape and all the green and the grasses, the flowers, especially the wildflowers in the spring and summer. When a child's able to go outside and play in that environment, be around that environment, when you can sit on a porch, as I used to with my mom as a kid, on a swing, in that kind of quiet moment, summer breeze, and just realize you see the little lightning bugs out, and it's just, it's magical. We never forget it. Those are remarkable, subtle moments that will completely change the behavior of children with ADHD. That's one piece of the puzzle. It's not everything. Then you start adding in the right other things, like blueberries. Yeah. I recommend every child with ADD and ADHD have at least one pint of blueberries a day or blueberry concentrate. And I'm not alone in that. In fact, University of Reading, which is in UK, said that a flavonoid-rich blueberry drink can improve mood in both children and young adults. Yes, indeedy. And so we should be having our blueberries every day and grapes every day as well. Remember, for older people, meaning over the age of 40, blueberries help your working memory. This was done against a placebo, and it was published in the peer-reviewed journal Applied Physiology, Nutrition, and Metabolism. It was significantly improved with blueberries. There's also a journal of agricultural and food chemistry showed the same thing. So, it's good. We are 23 minutes into the program. I'm going to take a break, and when we come back, you know what? I'm going to reverse it. When we come back, we're going to take a look at, and Ron from Lynbrook, I'll address your question. Thank you for calling in, or your statement. I'm interested in people making statements. But when we come back, let's go to, let me see. I thought I had it here. We didn't play it earlier. I'm going to ask Jesse. Jesse, if you could find the piece, what if Anthony Fauci was responsible for financing and hence doing the research? I've gained a research at the Wuhan Research Institute and the University of North Carolina, which actually created this virus, and then turns around and heads the program that's supposed to be helping us with it. If we can find that, we'll play that. If not, I thought you'd like to hear from 8 minutes. Oh, good, we'll have that. Also, I've just got the first copy of RFK's new documentary about the vaccine. And I'll play you just 8 minutes, but we found the Fauci vaccine, so we'll go to that first. Then an in-depth, original investigative report. Please stay with us.
We have new details for you in our special investigation into the origins of the pandemic. We're doing this because no one else is doing it properly. No one in the media, no one in our government, certainly not the WHO. And as we've said from the start, our investigation is not about pointing blame, but making sure we learn lessons to prevent the next pandemic. Now, there are two aspects to this story. One, did the virus leak from a lab in Wuhan? When this was first suggested, it was dismissed as a conspiracy theory. Now it's moving close to being the mainstream consensus. The Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, numerous other publications have since reported on the very details we brought to you in January. But the second aspect is perhaps even more troubling because it involves not the Chinese regime, no surprise they'd be engaged in denial, cover-up and misinformation, but our own government. It centers on the question of what exactly leaked from the Wuhan lab and why it was there. As we've laid out for you, there are reasonable grounds to suspect that SARS-CoV-2, the pandemic virus, which may have leaked accidentally, was the product of genetic experiments commissioned and funded by our own government. And we have new information on that tonight. The type of research we're talking about is called gain-of-function virus research. It aims to take a virus and then manipulate its genetic code to make it stronger and more contagious. The virus would gain new functions, hence the name. The thinking goes, if we could engineer the most deadly viruses ourselves in lab conditions, we could better prepare our pandemic response. The risk, of course, is that the genetically engineered virus gets loose. That's why gain-of-function research has always been highly controversial, ever since it began around a decade ago. So, in July 2014, a group of scientists from around the world came together to voice their concerns. They set up the Cambridge Working Group, quote, to coordinate efforts to enhance public understanding of the biosafety risks of such research, appropriate scrutiny and evaluation of its purported scientific and public health benefits, and appropriate regulation of such experiments that emphasizes the use of safer approaches to meet the same public health and scientific goals. Look who some of the founding members were. Dr. Thomas Inglesby, a frequent face on this channel during the pandemic. Dr. Michael Osterholm, resident epidemiologist at NBC. Dr. David Relman, he was on Bill Nye's podcast not long ago calling for a forensic investigation into the Wuhan lab. They were among the founding signatories, but there are literally hundreds of top scientists who signed on because they had the same concerns. They specifically called for an end to such experiments until their risks and benefits and potential alternatives had been fully explored. And as we've reported, in 2014, the Obama administration did place a moratorium on this kind of research, quote, following recent biosafety incidents at federal research facilities. The moratorium was lifted in 2017. But as we've also reported, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, or NIAID, run then, as now, by Dr. Fauci, funded this research project just before the ban was imposed and continued to fund it for 6 years, three of those during the ban. The money from NIAID was awarded to EcoHealth Alliance, run by a man called Peter Daszak, who then subcontracted the research to Shi Zhengli, head of the Infectious Diseases Unit at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Based on our own sources in the scientific community, we told you that this part of the grant represented gain-of-function research, and that this progress report tied to the grant described gain-of-function research that they did in fact carry out. They analyzed bat coronaviruses and sequenced their genetic information. They then built various chimeras, genetically engineered new viruses, man-made, in the lab. They infected human cells with them, in the lab. And they then showed that their man-made viruses could replicate as a functional virus. Why is this so important? Because the closest known virus to the one which started the pandemic is a bat coronavirus that we know was in the Wuhan lab. They told us it was a 96% match. That original virus was found years before in a mine 1,000 miles from Wuhan, where three people were infected and later died, from a new SARS-like respiratory illness. The only difference between that virus and the pandemic virus is how contagious it is. The pandemic virus, as we know, can be passed from human to human. The original virus could not. And that 4% genetic difference between them, it's in exactly the places where gain-of-function techniques would be used to make the virus more contagious. In technical language, the spike receptor binding domain and the furin cleavage site. So, while we can blame the Chinese regime for allowing the virus to leak, and especially for the cover-up afterwards, the terrifying truth may be that our own government commissioned the experiments that led to the creation of the pandemic virus in the first place. We've put all this to the National Institutes of Health, which oversees the NIAID, repeatedly. And they keep telling us the same thing. The grant that began in 2014 was not gain-of-function research, so it was not subject to the Obama administration's 2014 ban. So who's right? Well, we reached out to many of the scientists in the Cambridge Working Group. It's a long list, and we're still waiting for some replies, but we did hear back from dozens. Some disagreed with our sources that the 2014 grant and the 2017 study covered gain-of-function research. Many of them either didn't want to be quoted on the record or felt they weren't able to offer a view. But one of the most common things we heard back was, you should talk to Dr. Richard Ebright of Rutgers University. He's the real global expert on all this. So we did. And we greatly appreciate Dr. Ebright's help with this investigation. Here's what he told us. The original grant, in his view, was not gain-of-function research. But the project's renewal in 2019 unequivocally did include gain-of-function research of concern, his words, and should have been flagged for review. We've also been told that when researchers apply for grant renewals, they're often applying for retrospective approval, describing work they've already carried out or begun. The NIAID's renewal of this work in 2019, gain-of-function virus research of concern, according to one of the world's top experts in the field, was even closer to the outbreak of the pandemic. In case anyone at the NIH, its boss, Dr. Francis Collins, or NIAID's Dr. Fauci is watching, here's what we're going to do. Next week, we will ask you to respond directly to the new information we've reported tonight, that in 2019, you funded risky gain-of-function research involving bat coronaviruses at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, a lab which our own government, the one you're part of, warned in 2018 had serious biosafety issues. The more we dig into this story, the more it looks as if we're right, that you commissioned the genetic experiments that led to the creation of SARS-CoV-2, the pandemic virus, in a lab. If we're wrong, please come on here and explain why. And for all of you watching...
Okay. Now, since that was broadcast, we have a very important scientific article. It's over 109 pages, and I read it, every single line in it. And this is one of the world's leading authorities on this topic, and he said that it's not possible for this to have evolved naturally. And you heard what he said, that one bat, that one person in that cave, that sequence is the same. So what they do is they take something, and they've been doing this all over the world, and mainly it's done not because they want to make it a better world. It was done for decades, secretly. We did it for, I wrote the article, October 1985, about secret experiments, and I got my information from Freedom of Information Act. They've been doing this for a long time. They just didn't tell anyone. I remember I confronted one of the scientists when he was younger, and doing this work. He was down at a university hospital in Texas when I located him. And I said, I just want to confirm that you are the same scientist that worked on this particular secret experiment, of which there were over 1,000 of these experiments just with testing Americans with radiation to see what it would do to their bodies without their knowledge or consent. I gave an example of how at Sloan Kettering, they were using the person, and as well as a hospital for the indigenous people in Brooklyn, they were telling them they were giving them vitamin shots, and it was cancer. And the person responsible for it was not punished. and still was working at a major institute in Philadelphia. But I said, but they also fed children in hospitals radiation on toast to see what impact it would have on their kidneys. Again, nobody was informed. And so there was silence. And I said, were you that same person? He said, yes. And I said, can you explain the justification for putting people in harm's way? And he said, well, I was young, and when you're in the military, if you don't do what you're told, your career stops and you're out. And he said, would I do the same thing today? Probably not. But that I did younger in my career. Well, that was just one of the people. You ought to go back and download that article. We now have a new site, by the way, GaryAndAll.com, and it has over, or will by Monday, 800 of my published articles on it. And everything that I've done that I can actually document, independently document, so you can see the actual work. And all of my work is very meticulously documented. So that's what happens when you actually confront these people. So that was 30 years ago that they were doing this, and even earlier, and never acknowledging it, lying about it. And then when it comes out, they kind of, oh, okay, so what? As if we're the Pentagon, we're the Defense Department, we're the National Security Agency, we're the CIA. We're never held accountable, and they are right. Nor is the FBI. So just remember, these are the people you're counting upon to be honest and objective with you. And unfortunately, they are neither. All right, just something to consider before you start making judgments about what you can and can't trust. I'm going to take a few calls now, and then I'm going to go to my commentary, then come back because I think you'll have some comments about my commentary. But right now we have on the line from Georgia, we have Susan. Hi, Susan. Your turn.
Hi, Susan. Hi, Gary. I'm a little bit nervous. Bear with me. I just wanted to say briefly, I've been listening to you since 1985 when I was 25 years old. I'm now 64. And when I first heard you, just to tell you a little bit about my story, when I first heard you speak about how food affects your body, it clicked in my head. And then what I did is I studied how food affects your body, what it does to you. I turned into a vegetarian at 25. I've never wavered back and forth. I can honestly say that when I look at pictures of myself when I was 25 and now at 64 years old, I pretty much look the same. And I attribute all of that to the way I eat. I juice all the time. I take my vitamins. I think that people know that eating meat and fried food and all that junk is not good for them. And I find that people don't want to make any changes because they're just plain lazy. And when you don't eat like that, you definitely feel it in your body. You feel it spiritually. You look different in the mirror. When people ask me what my age is, they're actually shocked that I tell them I'm 64 and they can't believe it. And I let them know, they say, oh, it must be in your genes. And I said, no, it's the way I eat. It's the foods that I choose. And I also find that when my friend, I don't talk about food. I do not do that. But when people do ask me what I eat, I find that my friends kind of have a different attitude toward me. I can't quite make it out, but when they see that I'm a vegetarian or a vegan, they get quiet, and all of a sudden I feel the energy between them and myself changes. And I think it's because they kind of have to realize that, wow, we're the same age, or she looks younger than me, and she's so healthy, and I don't know what it is, but I do find that that's kind of interesting as well. And, Gary, I just want to tell you another quick story. This is so important to me. I've listened to everything that you say. I'm one of those very small percentage that actually follow what you teach us. I read all of your books. And I will tell you this. I hope that maybe this inspires somebody else. I was at a job once where I made a lot of money. I had great benefits, but I was miserable. And I remember back in the 80s, you always used to teach us, it's not how much money you make. It's all about being happy. And I'm not a materialistic person anyway, but I took this crappy job for a couple of years, and then I said to myself, you know what? I don't need the money. I don't need all of that. And I quit my job, and I've never looked back. I make less money, but I'm the happiest person ever. And I look at my friends who are still stuck in that job, and I say to them, God, that place is going to kill you. And I've never looked back, and I've never been so happy. And I encourage anybody, if you're not happy at what you're doing or in a relationship, get out of it now because it will kill you. Thank you so much, Gary. I so appreciate all that you do.
Thank you, Susan from Georgia. Now, I'm running short on time, so I want to go directly to this commentary. Richard Gale, my executive producer and one of our scholars in residence, and I work extensively on this. You can download it from PRN.fm and share it with people. For decades, according to a Guardian article, consumers worldwide have named the $347 billion pharmaceutical behemoth Johnson & Johnson as one of its most trusted brands. Well, from its humble beginnings in the 1880s, making cotton gauze dressing, and eventually they made Band-Aids and baby powder and shampoos, J&J has expanded into one of the most powerful multinational pharmaceutical and medical device companies in the world. In 1959, it entered the world of big pharma as a leading player after succeeding in getting Tylenol approved as an over-the-counter drug. Shortly thereafter, J&J commenced with a flurry of acquisitions to increase its product line, which included Neutrogena, Cordis, DuPuy, Janssen Pharmaceuticals, and Synacor. Today, in most American medicine cabinets, I would venture you'll find Listerine or Tylenol or Neutrogena skin cream or Rogaine, a Neosporin antibacterial ointment, or Destin to treat diaper rashes. Now, people are very eager for J&J's one-shot-and-you're-done COVID vaccine. Despite health officials' fears, it may be less effective than Moderna's and Pfizer's RNA competitors. Nevertheless, vaccination centers and pharmacies are racing to get their hands on the new adenovirus-based vaccine. And as you will note in a moment, this is from a company that has absolutely no past experience in vaccine development and manufacturing. However, we need to seriously challenge Johnson & Johnson's reputation. A 2019 report by the British intelligence firm Alva has noted that J&J's reputation has sunk dramatically during the past years, from ninth place among 58 major pharmaceutical firms to 57th out of 58. Certainly, that's at the bottom of the barrel. And this is not a company with clean ethical record. So why are we trusting them today? Why has the mainstream media not had a single report about their nefarious background that we're about to share with you? Not a single challenge on 60 Minutes or 2020. A review of J&J's rap sheet over the past just 30 years presents a dire and contrary image that should lead us to question the company's claims about its COVID-19 vaccine, given the lucrative market the pandemic has created for the most aggressive medical corporations. Similar to its equally oversized competitors, Glaxo, Merck, and Pfizer, too, has Johnson & Johnson had to pay out billions of dollars over the decades for civil settlements and criminal activities. As the pharmaceutical giant receives applause and only positive press and only positive acceptance across every part of the media and regulatory agencies, the release of the information by the FDA of its approval for its COVID-19 vaccine, Brazil's Public Prosecution Service started an investigation into Johnson & Johnson's antitrust activities under the Foreign Corrupt Practice Act, the FCPA, for, quote, possible improper payments in its medical device industry. What does that mean? Well, it states it. So what if doctors were using a device, or doctors were using a drug, or doctors using or about to use a vaccine based upon some financial incentive? This was part of an FBI bribery scheme investigation that included Siemens, General Electric, and Philips, acting as a large cartel to illegally pay off government officials in return for securing contracts with Brazil's national health programs. The charges also include price gouging, inflating prices up to 800% of the market price to cover bribes. This is not the first time Johnson & Johnson has violated these laws. In 2011, Johnson & Johnson was charged by the Department of Justice with conspiracy for paying off Greek doctors to advance its product sales. The SEC also charged civil complaints. The company had to pay out $70 million penalty for buying off officials in Greece, Poland, and Romania. In 2010, an executive for Johnson & Johnson's subsidiary, DuPay, was sentenced to a year in prison for corrupt payments to physicians within the Greek national health care system. A side question is, how many oncologists who buy at wholesale or cost chemotherapy and then advocate that at full retail with insurance coverage or co-payments covering the rest, making thousands of dollars per treatment per patient, and we consider that ethical? Is it? As one may recall, many doctors have been shown to receive honorariums, research grants, and direct stipends or stock in a company. All they have to do is write the right thing in medical journals, give the right endorsements, make the right statements, and all is good. But what if the product is not? The American public believes all products are clean and above board. Anything to challenge that would put doubt in the public's mind. As one of the world's leading medical device companies, Johnson & Johnson has had its share of recalls for faulty products, including contact lenses and hip implants. In 2013, it paid nearly $2.5 billion to compensate 8,000 recipients of its flawed hip implants. In 2016, another $1 billion was awarded to plaintiffs injured from this device. One particular dubious activity the company became involved with in 2008 was the launch of a, quote, phantom recall, end quote, when its Motrin IV caplets were discovered to not properly dissolve. It hired outside contractors to go in and buy up all of the supplies and stores in order to avoid making any public declarations. No one would have known of this activity, and it would have gotten past the eyes of the FDA inspectors had the deception not been exposed during a congressional investigation. But this is just a minor tip of the iceberg here. Other major Johnson & Johnson lawsuits and recalls for faulty products include 1995, $7.5 million fine for destroying documents to covering up an investigation into wrongful marketing of its written A acne cream to remove wrinkles. 1996, an undisclosed settlement on false claims over condom protection claims to protect against HIV and other STDs. 2000, Johnson & Johnson's subsidiary LifeScan was found guilty of selling defective blood glucose monitors and failed to inform the FDA. All told, $105 million was paid out on just that one action. In 2001, Johnson & Johnson paid out $860 million in a class action lawsuit for misleading consumers about prematurely discarding a one-day Acuvue soft contact lens. It was Johnson & Johnson recommended they should only be worn once, although it was discovered the lenses were no different than the regular lens that you could use for 2 weeks. 2010, $81 million settlement for misbranding its anti-epileptic drug Atopamax to treat psychiatric disorders and hiring outside physicians to join its sales force to promote the drug for unapproved conditions. The following year, Johnson & Johnson paid $85 million for similar charges against his heart drug, Natricor. In 2011, several of his baby products were discovered to contain carcinogenic ingredients. In 2013, the U.S. Justice Department charged the company $2.2 billion in criminal fines for marketing its autism and antipsychotic drug Risperdal for unapproved uses. 45 states had filed lawsuits, and that's still a part of the scandal. And by the way, Risperdal is horrendous as a drug. It contributes to rapid weight gain and a condition that means it has irregular enlarged breasts in men. In fact, Simowise reports that Johnson & Johnson's subsidiary, Janssen, also had an aggressive campaign to market its use in children with behavioral challenges. Other serious adverse effects from Risperdal reported by the FDA included diabetes mellitus, also depression, anxiety, psychotic behavior, suicide, and death. Well, for Risperdal, sales in the United States and documents have tied him to the scandal. Yet, rather than force his resignation, he later became the president of Janssen and eventually Johnson & Johnson's chairman and CEO for total compensation of $21 million. The company's legal problems over Risperdal do not appear to have ended. In October 1919, a Philadelphia jury awarded a man $8 billion in punitive damages for failing to warn that the drug could cause young men to grow breasts. Other recent suits include litigation over its blood thinning, risks of internal bleeding, and a $775 million settlement to 25,000 plaintiffs. In 2016, two women were awarded $127 million in damages for the talc and its Johnson & Johnson baby powder causing ovarian cancer. Later, over 1,000 similar cases came forward. And during the trial, it was discovered that Johnson & Johnson suspected a link between talcum and ovarian cancer when, in the 1970s, they've known this, suspected this, and hid it. A Missouri verdict fined the company over $4 billion. It was later reduced to $2.1 billion. A New York Times investigation into internal Johnson & Johnson's memos uncovered evidence that the talcum powder may have contained asbestos. These cases continued today. In July 2019, Johnson & Johnson made efforts to dismiss 14,000 lawsuits over the talcum cancer risk. More recently, Johnson & Johnson has been in the spotlight for its role in contributing to the deadly opiate crisis. The company holds the patent for a unique strain of opium poppy, commonly named Norman. It is the leading provider of the opiate for Purdue Pharmaceuticals painkiller OxyContin. An Oklahoma court ordered a $465 million fine. This opened the door for other states to follow suit. Now, to fully realize how insane this system is, the $500 million civil fine was good news on Wall Street, which anticipated the verdict would be in the billions of dollars. So it was only $500 million. So consequently, Johnson & Johnson's stock rose 2% after the judge's ruling. And despite Johnson & Johnson's being Purdue's major supplier and a major contributor to the U.S. opiate epidemic, the latter was forced to file bankruptcy due to mounting lawsuits over drug overdose, but not Johnson & Johnson. Finally, we have to ask a basic question. Why a 140-year-old company with no history whatsoever in vaccine development has now become among the heroes in the immunological war against COVID-19? Johnson & Johnson is not a household name in the vaccine industry. It is utterly absent, let alone ranks among the world's 20 major vaccine makers. Not at all. Among the 53 vaccines for other infections approved and licensed by the CDC, not one is manufactured by the nation's leading producer of mouthwash and baby powder. It is therefore no surprise that the company had to partner with Merck to manufacture its COVID vaccine to meet demand. It has no history or expertise in this medical field. However, the COVID pandemic is a cash cow for the drug industry's taking. Bernstein market analyst Rodney Gall predicts COVID-19 vaccines will reach at least $40 billion this year. A more realistic figure is likely to be much higher because Moderna and Pfizer already project revenues at $32 billion. Then there are the other major vaccines made by AstraZeneca and Novavax entering the competition. So according to the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine's Vaccine Research Tracker, over 200 vaccines against COVID are right now in development worldwide. It's an enormous pumpkin pie, and everybody in the medical universe wants a slice from it. So why shouldn't we expect a non-vaccine maker such as Johnson & Johnson to be eager to leap into the frenzy? And so that is that. Something to consider. None of what I've just shared with you has been told by anyone in the media just praising the new vaccine without looking at the company, its history, and all those who've been injured or died, the scandals, as if somehow that's all yesterday's news. No, not when you're bringing out something that has never been done before and now expecting a completely different outcome. I'm Gary Knoll. And for those of you listening on BAI, thank you for listening. We'll cut away so you get the news. For everyone else, your turn to call in now. We'll go back to the calls, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. And we have on the line now, who do we have? We can go to, I saw some names earlier. Bob from Brooklyn. Bob, your turn. Oh, Ron, your turn.
Well,
hi, Ron. You're on.
Yeah, listen, Dr. Gary Knoll, listen, I have a question for you. Back in 1983, I know you're a man of medicine, I was diagnosed bipolar, and I've been on a steady regimen of lithium up until now, but I've had no episodes, and the medication is down to one pill a day. And I thought the what I lived through back in the 80s was turbulent, but now I feel stable. Should I stay with the medication? I get my blood tested every 6 months.
As you know, I do not recommend anyone ever go off their medications without their doctor's consent and approval. As I do not tell people to vaccinate or not to vaccinate, I merely present evidence that they otherwise would not have so they can make a more informed and intelligent decision. What I would suggest, however, is that if you're at the lowest dose, which is good, and you're getting the benefits that you previously would have had at a higher dose, so that's better still, then you should fortify your body so that your immune system, your brain chemistry, your body's hormone levels are all maintained at a higher level. For that, you should contact any one of the multiple let's say, more holistic physicians, people who specialize in helping people who are on medications rebalance their body's homeostasis so that they don't end up with adverse effects, or if they have adverse effects, help them overcome that. And there's no shortages of good quality people in the whole New York City area. There probably is about 200 to 300 of those people. And so just look up not a nutritionist, not a dietitian, but a physician who would have a good understanding, and also a physician, ideally a holistic neurologist or holistic psychiatrist. Dr. Peter Bregan, and you could consult with him up in Ithaca, would be one good example of someone who could help you. Because right now you don't have to be in their office for most things. You can do it by Zoom. All right, all the best to you, Ron. And we are out of time, everyone, but I want to thank you for listening in today. And by the way, last call out, because I believe that we are about out of time for our anti-aging two-week group. That's the last 2 weeks of April. I'm going to be doing a lot of original new work there. It'll be one of the most exciting and original studies, human studies, non-invasive, non-medical, ever done. Or, by the way, the other article is now in for peer review. We've gotten tentative acceptance. It's an official pipeline, so it wasn't rejected. And within the next couple of weeks, we'll hear that it's been accepted, and then we'll announce it. So those of you who would like to read the study can. You can call Luann if you're interested in trying to reverse your aging, motivate yourself. Be like Susan down in Georgia. Started it in her mid-20s, now in her mid-60s, and she looks and feels the same. That's the difference. And I know there are a lot of you in this audience who can say when you go to a reunion, you look like they're children of the people that you went to school with, not like them. So my mother said this. She said, look carefully when you get to your first goal in life to see if it's what you expected and if it's what you want. And I listened to what she had to say, but there was something I felt I had to do that was different. And that was ask myself, what choices can I make to reach a goal on an ethical and moral level? And so by making your choices in advance and following the higher ideal, it may take you longer to get someplace where you want to go, but that journey is going to be much more pleasing. It'll be less stressful. You don't have to rush it. And when you do get there, you don't have to lose night's sleep based on all the mistakes and shortcuts you've made. So for those of you who want to try to do something about your aging, who feel that you deserve a second chance to make over, and let me tell you, for the men and women in this audience or others who have ever seen an old car gotten out of a junkyard, more often than not, years of time put on restoring it, frame off restoration, and then one day you go to one of these antique car auctions and there it is. I bought one, a 57 Chevy convertible, 100% restoration. It's just like it came off the assembly line. And I bought it for $33,000. It's now worth about $80,000. You appreciate what can be done when a person puts their mind to it. Imagine the frame-off restoration of your body and your brain and your muscles, your hormones. All right? It's possible.